It's now 2 o'clock, time for a conversation with the reluctant therapist. The following program represents views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes the comments of those with divergent views. Our phone number for today is 805-549-8855. Hi, Elizabeth.
I'm Elizabeth. Hi, Sarah. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I am a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And I'm also aware of the privilege that I have in doing this weekly show. And I'm working hard every day to figure out how to best use this platform to elevate voices and perspectives in our collective fight against racial inequity. And I'm aware that I may not be the best voice for that conversation at this time. So for this BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month, I'm adding listener and student to my bio and handing the mic to two guest hosts who will be sharing their worldviews and experiences as members of Generation Z and the BIPOC community. So I look forward to stepping aside and into the student and listener role because it's a lot of pressure to always be trying to move information out. It's a great feeling to be able to just allow information to come towards me for a while. And I want to encourage you all to allow yourself to step into the space, even if whatever topics come up this month or conversations might make you feel uncomfortable or experience some dissonance in your own thoughts and feelings, and hearing and learning new information that might conflict with or make you cringe a bit because you might hear yourself in some of the conversations. I know I have had that experience more often than I care to admit, or the course of being an instructor at the university and doing the show, where people will describe experiences that have made them uncomfortable or didn't seem to go right. And I can hear my own voice in that and think, oh my goodness, was that me? And having to sit with that embarrassment or sit with that discomfort or sit with that dissonance is a part of growing as human beings. And I tell my students this every day in class. If you're not uncomfortable, you're not growing. And so this is an opportunity for growth for myself and for you, and also for my guest hosts, David Gudiel and Aliyah Sade. And you've heard their voices. They were here last week, and we were talking a bit generally about mental health and the need for bringing in mental health services, but what kind of mental health services would be helpful. And David's also been a guest as one of my former students. I have high regard and respect for both of these young people because they are walking their talks and doing their work constantly. So I feel comfortable handing this show and this conversation over to them for a few weeks. That doesn't mean I'm going anywhere because I'm going to still sit in the room because I, again, am in the role of student and listener. So I'll be hopefully being able to help them navigate this new field and also to kind of keep a foundation for the show. And although we won't be opening up the phone for calls, which is kind of the way of the world with our new format, over Zoom, but you can still be part of the conversation. I encourage you to, if you have comments or questions or concerns, you can call 805-549-8855 and leave that question for Sarah, that comment. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT, or our Facebook page. You can leave messages there. And if you'd like to share this show or listen to previous shows, you can listen to kcbx.org under the podcast tab, or podcast the show and upload to your device to listen at your convenience. And our guests today, I'm sure, will hand off their information. If you want to connect directly with them, they'll pass on that information to you. But I am happy to be here, privileged to be part of this community. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and we'll be back in a moment to hand over the mic and get to know our guests.
sharpening the knives in the attic, trying to watch cartoons through the static, thinking where am I gonna be if I'm ever 23. Oh, I'm looking at life unfold, dreaming of the green and gold, just like the ancient stone. Every sunrise I know, those eyes you gave to me, they let me see where I come from. Find an old friend, meeting my guitar in the city, feeling like a star.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And our guest hosts for this month, BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month, are David Gudiel and Aliyah Sade. Welcome to your guest host position. Where are you taking us today? Where are we starting off?
Well, first, I'll start off with introducing myself. My name is David Gudiel. I am a recent college grad. I'm a local San Diegan. I'm a fiance, I'm a student, I'm a yogi, an artist, a dancer, and a joy bringer is one of my favorite new things to say. And then I will pass it on to Aliyah.
Hello, my name is Aliyah Sade. I use she, her pronouns. I am a yoga instructor, a student herbalist, a recent graduate of UCLA in the World Arts and Cultures department, and I've worked as a first responder. I've worked in research. And right now I'm really operating in my joy activism, bringing joy and centering wellness throughout this movement. And today I would kind of like to start off by talking about BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month. This has been around since 2008. And just to kind of break down BIPOC, BIPOC stands for Black Indigenous People of Color. And the reason that we've moved away from using Minority Mental Health or Marginalized People's Mental Health Awareness Month is because sometimes those terms can be used to make our communities, Black Indigenous People of Color communities, feel inferior or feel othered. And what we're trying to do in this month is bring those experiences and those disproportionate negative experiences with mental health and mental services to the forefront and to the center, rather than having them on the outskirts, and really center Black Indigenous People of Color wellness and think about ways that we can transform the society that we're operating within, starting with the care that we're giving these populations, which David and I are both a community of.
Yes. So just some of the things that we wanted to just bring up is like the language, you know, why is it that language is so important? And for me, like, I graduated with psychology at Cal Poly SLO, and I think the way I understand language is very much, it kind of builds our world, it builds our reality, it builds the way we name things, it gives power to what we see and interact with every day. And the reason why, and being critical of language, is because language is part of our culture, and culture is always shifting. So as we're going through our daily life, it's important to be cognizant of the language that we use, who, where did we learn this language from, and understanding the past and the history of what brought us to today, and also being able to have the power to change the terms we no longer accept, and having the power to, you know, make a certain word be present in our history and add to the dictionary. Because at one point, you know, there's always like the new word in the dictionary. So it's like, why can't BIPOC, Black Indigenous People of Color, make their new terms for the way they label their stress or their traumas or their experiences? And how that just changes things.
Right. And when we shift the language around the way that we even define ourselves and define the care that we're giving, we can really start to unearth or unravel and pack some of the power structures that have always been prevalent in our society. And right now there's a huge spotlight on the Black Lives Matter movement and the disparities that Black folks are facing in healthcare. And I am a a Black Chicana woman. And of course, I have also experienced, you know, a disservice to my mental wellness through social workers and through therapists that I've worked with. And I think when we are talking about language, the way that we name things, so the way that we name our experiences and the way that our experiences are named by others can make it seem like just existing in a Black body is pathology. So I've learned that in defining myself, for instance, as a survivor, joy activist, I have the opportunity to name my experience and share my story and share my truth, and also make space for connection and questions and curiosity. So I think that just thinking about all the labels that we gave ourselves, not as boxes that we put ourselves in, but rather as places where people can connect with us and begin to understand the ways that our experiences are similar and different, and unpack the power dynamics within those similarities and differences.
So explain to me the power dynamics piece, the difference between you choosing how you want to be identified and maybe being told how you are, who you are, you know, how does that change with your generation or these generation?
You want to take that one?
So I think that there's something that Audre Lorde said. She is a Black feminist writer and scholar. She said, if I don't write my own story, they'll write it and they'll call me crazy, you know, and that is, they'll stigmatize it because they don't understand it. And I think learning to name ourselves and name our experiences in ways that we see fit restores our agency. Because when another person is labeling you or using their language, they're just perpetuating oppression in a way. Because a lot of the terms that we've learned are rooted in something that centers whiteness or Eurocentric values. So it's like when you're outside of that whiteness or outside of those Eurocentric values, like someone living in a Black body like myself, then you're being named as divergent or neuroatypical, or, you know, I identify as queer. So just thinking about how, you know, less than 50 years ago, that was considered an illness.
In the DSM.
And you could be hospitalized for that. Whereas now I get to name that. It's not a slur for me. Instead, it's like a source of empowerment and agency. And yeah, I think that that example right there just shows a way in which our generation, like myself, like we've worked to transform the meaning behind words and reclaim them for ourselves.
So I think when you talk about people of color, you and I had talked earlier about how that even that term has been shifted and reworked in a positive, because it was so closely related to a negative connotation. If you say colored people, now it's been switched. How did that term come to change?
That's a very good question. I think colored people is something that was rooted in Jim Crow segregation and had a very distinct connotation to it of otherness. Whereas people of color has been a term that's been reclaimed by folks from all different types of backgrounds as a political identity, identifying with the norm that is outside of that whiteness, identifying with the norm that is outside of the hegemony, outside of the dominant culture. And I think when we look to those folks who are outside of the dominant culture, like people of color, naming their own experience, we can begin to imagine what would it be like for people of color, mental health, mental wellness to be the center. How would that transform the way that care is received, care is given, education to psychologists and psychiatrists is performed? It honestly flips things on their head. And I think that a lot of people are uncomfortable with saying people of color, and it seems like a very politically correct thing to say, but our generation, what I've noticed is we're trying to move away from political correctness and come into having those hard conversations and using the language to distinctly and concisely name what's happening in our society. Because when we name that we're people of color, and because of that we have all of these different experiences and all of these oppressions that we're facing, then we can begin to address how that looks in the spaces that we're in, how that looks in our relationships.
Well, because you talked about identifying as queer and taking back that term as well, because at one point it would have been considered a slur or a negative as an identification, but now that also changes in culture. And does that become a generational thing then? Do you have to be of Gen Z to be able to utilize these identities without, you know, stepping out of place? Is it become part of just the vernacular in general?
I think that it has been a part of the vernacular for some time. And I think that scholars who were millennials have been using these terms for many years in research that is centering like Black feminism. It's just that now we're seeing with social media, these terms have come into the mainstream and people have begun to discover them and name themselves that way. And it's almost like that eureka moment when you're just looking for a way to name what you're experiencing, and then someone puts the word out there. So now these words that were just high in academia or high in like these communities that are outside of the mainstream culture have become centered and normalized because they're giving us the language to name what's going on. And it's been a source of pride for a lot of people to be able to say person of color and call in other people of color to come into their spaces. And also it encourages folks who are not people of color, like per se someone who is white, to also acknowledge their own identity and the privilege and power that comes with that.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest hosts for this month are David Gudiel and Aliyah Sade. They are college graduates. They are an engaged couple. They are activists, and they are generously sharing their perspective and worldviews with us. Today we're kind of starting at the beginning, I guess, David, with the idea of language and identity and how to have these conversations. How is language pushing the conversation about social inequities right now? How is it how is it bringing together a community dialogue, or have we found a common way to talk about the social inequities that are being fought right now?
I feel like, you know, we're talking about, you know, people of color and like kind of that pride of definition and stuff. But even when we use people of color, it seems like there's this group of white and then like people of color, you know. So if you flip it on its head, it's like, well, who are those of not color and why do we use that? And even when we use the term people of color, we're lumping in BIPOC, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color. It's just so many different ethnicities and relations of race. And even when we talk about race, race is a social construct. It was literally made in quote unquote scientific terms. And when you kind of look at it in the larger history of the world that we've existed, it basically was like white men telling other white men that we're going to agree to use this word and classify people based on how they look. And as we go more into the, you know, I think the internet has been a great tool into bringing these communities together to have these dialogues, because, you know, like let's say in Mexico, you can have people that are of light skin with green eyes and blonde straight hair, and you can also have Indigenous people with darker skin. And it's like, where is that a person of color? Are we conflating racial, ethnic, or nationalities with people of color? So it's kind of like those things that we like, it must bring us together to talk, because even it's like in the Mexico example, like there is anti-Indigeneity and anti-Blackness that affects people in there. So not every person of color has the exact same experience. So that's something to talk about as well. Black people will live the world a different way and be viewed differently than, you know, people that are from Asia, people that are from Latin America. And even in Latin America, there's Black people, and in Asia, there's Black people. So it's like, how do we discern and talk about and break all these things down? And it kind of just turns, like, instead of turning towards each other, it's kind of turning to each other and saying, like, well, who named these structures? and kind of like going all the way back, going back to Charles Darwin and seeing like bioexistentialism and looking at the history of like eugenics and why were certain people trying to be taken away. It's kind of like looking at those power structures, and those power structures and language falls into everything that we touch. It falls into the medical field. It falls into education. And it's important for us to kind of remember that, like, you know, science, and at least Western science, is one way of viewing the world, because there has been many ways of classifying people and identities and a larger history of the world. And that's still new to us. So it's kind of like looking at, you know, where, like, when we say minority mental health, it's kind of like saying, well, what is a minority? Because in California, there's like this demographic that like there is a lot of racial diversity here. So are we really, are like, you know, are Latinx people a minority when they're the majority or soon to be the majority in California? And does that shift? So one thing that I had seen that I saw like on Instagram was this quote on different terms and kind of how they're talked about. So I'm going to just read a little bit of it. But it says like, diversity asks, who's in the room? Equity responds, who is trying to get in the room but can't? Whose presence is in the room under a constant threat of erasure? Inclusion asks, has everyone's ideas been heard? Justice responds, whose ideas won't be taken as seriously because they aren't in the majority? Diversity asks, how many more of pick a marginalized identity group do we have this year than last? Equity responds, what conditions have we created that maintain certain groups as a perpetual majority here? Inclusions ask, is this environment safe for everyone to feel like they belong? Justice challenges, whose safety is being sacrificed and minimized to allow others to be comfortable maintaining dehumanizing values? And this is from Tafina Lazarus Stewart.
All right, so unpack that, David. How does that resonate with you and with the story that's being played out right now? How would people understand the difference between inequity and equality? You know, how do these voices get amplified?
I mean, it just depends kind of on what platform, because every situation is going to be different, and that's the context. It's like, sometimes it's important to know what these words mean, but also understand what contexts are being used to have that meaning. Because we can be like, you know, there's diversity in the room and just be a lot of different European people from different countries. That's diversity, but they're also most than likely white. And they also have this certain power structure in society, you know? So it's just different things. Like my favorite example of equity, equality, and justice is there's like kids trying to see a game, a football game, and equality is giving everyone the same box to stand upon to look over the fence because they can't see, right? And then equity is giving the person who is shorter more boxes so they can see over it. But justice is taking away the fence so that they can see the game. So it's kind of like when we're asking for equity, when we're asking for inclusion, we're still perpetuating the same power dynamic that calls for that, instead of justice being like, let's dismantle that, let's shift that, let's change the way that this works.
Right. So if I'm understanding you, instead of trying to balance the boxes so it's fair, that's still not fair for everyone, because if you're taller than the person next to you, having the same box still gives you an advantage. Mm-hmm. But better so than needing the box, we take that fence down so that everyone has access to whatever they're all trying to work towards, whether that's education or healthcare.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
and just thinking about that was such a beautiful example to use, because it makes me think about mental health care in the United States and how that fence is blocking wellness for some folks. The football game is wellness, you know? And if we could just restructure, dismantle all of the oppressive systems that get perpetuated through mental health care and through mental health care education and all these things, then maybe every community, more communities would have access to that wellness, not just whoever can see over that fence. And, what? Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to, and then I was thinking, and maybe it's not that everyone wants to be able to get into the football game. You know, maybe that fence that we've erected that everyone's trying to get to really shouldn't be the goal. And I wonder if that's not part of the conversation, is that what we're teaching young people to strive towards may not be in their best interest, may not be the best goal.
Like maybe wellness isn't just a bubble bath and a fancy house. Maybe that's not what we should be striving for. And we need to have a more diverse conversation about what that looks like. And when we're talking about BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month, how can we transform our care systems to where folks of color who are coming in with hundreds of years of systemic trauma aren't being given a pill and told that that's going to solve the issue?
Yeah, because I was going to say, I think of sometimes like when we have like terms like inclusion and equity and things like that, it's like, it's kind of seen like, say, therapy as the example, you know, thinking like we need more BIPOC therapists. And it's like, okay, yes, that is one solution of it. But is that still taking away from the system that's causing harm to BIPOC to need BIPOC therapists? So it's kind of like looking at the system of like, you know, is this going to give us more people to have these resources, or are we even stopping the problem before it gets there and looking at other ways to help or assist or shift that narrative, things like that?
I know it's interesting when we talk about mental health, we talk about finding more resources and more mental health professionals, but we rarely talk about trying to not need mental health professionals to take away those barriers to wellness.
Right. And it's like no one wants to be out of a job.
Well, there is a danger in that as well. Could these, in a lot of ways, all the institutions that we talk about needing to dismantle or to change mean that a lot of people's livelihoods end. And I think that is frightening. You know, what would I do if I wasn't a social worker? What if we didn't need social workers? What if we didn't need the police? What would people do every day? And I think the ending of institutions frightens people.
And that's such a powerful reflection to offer, because I think a lot of people are feeling that fear right now. Just thinking about the climate of defund the police, something we talked about last week, thinking about dismantling systems of oppression, we have to acknowledge the ways that all of our activities are touched by oppression, and how, and imagine how we're going to create new livelihoods. And imagine how we're going to all work together to figure out what that new system looks like. Because I imagine everyone's imagination is a bit different, and it's hard to imagine something outside of what we have when we're not encouraged to.
And it goes back, I really loved that fence metaphor, Dave. I'm going to keep going back to it. Because then, again, our public education system, or what we tell young people from the time they're young, here is what you should strive for. But is it in anyone's best interest to be striving for a 40 or 60 hour a week job in a cubicle somewhere that leaves you very little time to be with your family? Like, is that in anyone's best interest? But that is such an institution. When you look at an economy, that 70% of the economy is linked towards consumption. So the whole operation of this country is around this idea that everyone needs to be striving to consume and, you know, aspire to a cubicle.
Yeah, like there was this quote that I saw the other day that was like, what is your dream job? And they were like, I don't dream of working. Like, that's not my aspiration, to be working in something. Like, I want to dream of other things that don't involve work. So it's kind of like, you brought up a good point that our country is so rooted in product and producing and consuming. Because I think at the end of the day, when we look at that, like, I just think that this pandemic has just offered us so much insight to what do we consume, and like how reliant are we on these other entities to give to us, and how disempowered have we been through these structures. And like, I'm thinking about, you know, food security. Like, you know, we build a world where we can put as many people on a certain piece of land, and taking away the ability to work and live off the land, because then it supports the need to go to the grocery store and pay that business to give you food. And we know that that business underpays the workers in the fields to get their fruits from. So it just kind of, it's this all entangled thing. Yeah.
It's when we talk about the systems, it's greater than just the institutions of public education or mental health, that it comes to the agricultural system and how people have the ability to access food or clean water. You know, if you stripped it all away for all human beings, the oppression of the institution that demands that in order to get food, we have to get a job to pay for the food, when mm-hmm. the food is capable of being grown right here in our yards. Like, I think that maybe is going off task, but you keep leading me down those thought paths.
All connected.
It's all connected. And I think on the topic of language and how we name things, we have to name these like systems of oppression that we're talking about, just consumerism, capitalism. I know it sounds scary to say capitalism might be a bad thing, but is capitalism contributing to wellness for folks? Is it contributing to wellness for Black, Indigenous, people of color? I know in my family that that hasn't been the case. I know in my community that that hasn't been the case. So it's just creating space when we begin to name these things as well.
If you're just tuning in, oh, sorry, David. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and I'm warming up my guest host for the month of July, David Goodiel and Aliyah Sade. And we're kind of, feels like we're tap dancing a little bit, but we're trying to touch into some new territory, new language, new way of envisioning what this world looks like collectively moving forward as we collectively as a culture fight social and racial inequities. And what does equity actually look like? What really needs to be dismantled for us to get there? And we're going to take a quick break, recalibrate our thoughts. And you are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Baird, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And although we're not opening the phone lines today. You can share your thoughts by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast this show to listen at your convenience or to share with friends by visiting anywhere you get your podcasts. Hit subscribe and upload. And for this month, BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month, my guest hosts are David Gudiel and Aliyah Sade, recent college graduates, Gen Zs, activists, engaged couple, joy bringers, revisionaries of the future. I don't know how many different things to label you both with, but we're kind of talking about labels and identities and how those labels and identities really inform our opportunities or lack of opportunities in culture and in society. And so, David, I'm handing it over to you. Let's talk about BIPOC mental health and if you want to define it again and why this is an important conversation.
Yes. So, again, BIPOC stands for Black Indigenous People of Color. And the reason why there's an emphasis on this month is because other terms like saying Minority Mental Health Awareness Month can perpetuate it. Feelings of otherness or inferiority in the social world that we exist in. So what I wanted to talk about, and the reason why it's important is because of systems of oppression like racism, misogyny, sexism, anti-blackness, these things, BIPOC will have different experiences as they navigate through the world. The laws that they will face will be different towards them, the repercussions of that. And I keep coming to this pandemic and COVID because it's bringing to surface so many issues of inequality in this country and most importantly, like globally, like in this world. So one thing that I wanted to share from Dr. Sean Jinwright is this quote that from this article in the San Francisco Chronicle, coronavirus underscores need for healing in America's racial division. And part of it says, in communities of color, trauma and crisis are commonplace, and as a result, many African-American and Latino families have learned to work and live persistently traumatic and stressful environments. Let me say that again, persistent traumatic stress environment, not post-traumatic stress disorder. This is an important distinction. First, PTSD focuses on the root causes of health disparities, like food insecurity, lack of housing, and medical care. PTSD diagnoses only disorder resulting from a past experience. African-American and Latino communities often experience greater stress, anxiety, and depression because of lack of safety, economic opportunities, and basic housing. So I wanted to bring that up because it also ties into how we view health. When we view mental health, you know, mental health is an individual thing, an interpersonal thing, and a community thing. And it also touches up on the social determinants of health. So the social determinants of health is kind of what labels or makes together the overall wellness. And I'm going to read some of them. So it's composed of economic stability, neighborhood and physical environment, education, food, community and social context, and the healthcare system.
So what you're saying is those are the foundational needs for mental wellness for individuals and a community.
Yeah, that's what makes health, you know. I like to think that like mental health doesn't always exist alone. Mental health exists as a result or as a consequence of other things down the line, down the system, let it be legislative policies, let it be community actions and things like that. And it's different, you know, not like I mentioned earlier, not every person of color is going to have the same oppression when they navigate this world. You know, indigenous struggles are going to be different because they deal with issues on sovereignty. And, you know, coming to the 4th of July, which was a couple of days ago, like, were we really free when Black people weren't free? When the founding fathers, almost all of them had slaves. Like, what does that say? And, you know, the way that they treated indigenous people when they came to the United States and took them, displaced them from their homes, and the way we even talk about it in history today, you know, there's a book that says that the Trail of Tears that was made by Andrew Jackson was just, you know, they packed up their things and moved elsewhere, when that's not really the truth. And it was a violent displacement of people's homes in history, and the intergenerational trauma that happens. Black people in this country experience, you know, history of slavery and what that looks like, and still the fight. You know, we had Jim Crow 60 years ago. The civil rights movement wasn't that long ago. Asian people deal with issues of immigration, but more like on the West Coast, and what that looked like when, you know, they didn't want them here for the gold rush, but they used them to build the railroads, and what that looked like. You know, what were the causes of health that gets passed down through our genetics? And then now the model minority, where they're viewed as the people of color you want to be like, you know, assimilated to this white capitalistic culture. And Latinx people deal with border issues and immigration as well, too. Like, being on this same land that over history was fought and changed. Like, who gets to draw the line of, like, this is America and this is not America? And people that were here for generations and were taken out of their country, put somewhere else, and to manage and maintain the status quo of white America and things like that. So it's just understanding these histories is just step one into making, you know, creating language of the present, because the present is so tied to our past and so tied to our future that we must always be cognizant of that. You know, slavery didn't end on June 19th. It's still happening today. It's called the prison industrial complex, you know, the 13th Amendment. So it's like, what kind of stress does that have when disproportionately Black and Latino men are put in prison and are disrupting the family cycle, you know, takes away another source of income, creates housing insecurity, food insecurity, creates mental health issues for the children who get to see that and live in fear of the police today. So it's just all these different things coming together.
And so you used the term persistent traumatic stress.
Environment.
And you also threw in there intergenerational trauma. And I just don't want you to go so fast that we know that we kind of miss the connection, because I think it's so important. So I want to make sure that I'm getting this. The persistent traumatic stress environment, I understand, because when you are having to work two or three jobs just to put food on the table and fear for your children's safety, and you live in a food desert, which means you live in a community that doesn't have a shopping center or a grocery store, and you're ending up at the AM/PM to buy your goods. That to me is an obvious source of persistent stress that would carry into someone's life. And we know that stress is fundamental in people's mental health or mental illness, more so than any biological or chemical disorder. When someone is under persistent stress, it undermines their mental wellness. But talk a bit about the intergenerational trauma and what that looks like, because I think a lot of people tend to scoff very quickly at this idea of, oh, are we still talking about slavery impacting families? Or are we still talking, that can't still be a problem. But if you look at science, DNA is altered right? Our DNA is altered when we experience stressful experiences like slavery or Jim Crow laws. And that DNA switch impacts the next generation. Our children are born, or these children are already born, predisposed to higher levels of stress. And I don't want to run with it, but explain that more.
I can talk. Okay, so one way that I like to view, and I recommend this because Professor Bear recommended it to us in class, was reading the book Ishmael, which is a really good way of thinking of how we as humans place ourselves in this universe. You know, the quote that's like, I don't exist in the universe, I'm part of the universe, because at the end of the day, we're biological creatures. You know, we want to define it that way. And what I mean by that is, like, because I was a biology major and I wanted to be a doctor, so I got some background on there too. And it's like, you know, biology and DNA are just ways that genetics has been coded that will best fit to survive our environment. And that changes over time. So one example in my behavioral genetics class was on mice and stress. So what would happen was, if the mother mouse, you know, licked the little baby mice a lot, it created a sense of comfort, which meant this is a safety sense, you know? And then the baby mice would, like, there's a hormone that was not getting dropped. Then basically they would grow up and, you know, not be worried about the environment. In a different case, when they weren't licked a lot, it created a sense of stress within the puppy mice. And what that is, it releases a hormone into them that later makes them more attuned to their environment, more likely to be receptive to any sound, because it creates a sense of, you know, I'm like, the biology and the genetics code it to be more in tune for any threats and for the sense of safety. And so when we look at that on one biological organism, it's kind of like taking it to us and seeing the ways we develop anxiety. You know, at the end of the day, like, being anxious or things like that, at one point served us a purpose. It served us a purpose when we walked through the woods and we're careful of what might attack us. You know, you do have to be paying attention. Your mind does serve a purpose of creating scenarios because it creates a scenario of preparedness. But now when we live in this world where other things are met, there's a cognitive dissonance to what our biological things want to react and what our reality shows us. You know, feeling with that gut feeling of unsafety, what does that create for you? You know, it makes you lose appetite, which decreases your nutrition. It releases more cortisol, which compromises your immune system. And it just goes back and forth. I loved biopsychology when I was at Poly because it showed the connection between the microscopic, you know, the DNA, and then the macroscopic of our body as a whole body, as a whole, you know, going from like, that's the best way I could describe it, I guess.
Right. And I love the way that you talked about how the things we see in our society are also prevalent on a molecular level and everything is connected in that way. When I think about intergenerational trauma, there's been a term coined for a long time called post-traumatic slave syndrome. And it really refers specifically to the Black American experience and the mental health struggles we face just due to hundreds and hundreds of years of emotional abuse, enslavement, and then after that, discrimination that has continued. We're still seeing that discrimination and power imbalance continued in our workplaces and our social status. And when I think of intergenerational trauma, in some way I've really seen it manifest in my personal life, I think of my family, who is, for the most part, all of the women have quote unquote clinical obesity. And I see this issue that's, you know, it's called an issue and they're deemed high risk for all these reasons. And I really think back far enough and I'm like, wow, my direct ancestors have access to food in ways that their ancestors did not. And I think about the enslaved Africans who were able to survive the transatlantic slave route and what type of metabolism that they had to have. They had to have a metabolism that could eat a potato and survive on it for 5 days. So when I think about my mom, who has this relationship with food and has showed on her body like an accumulation of like fat tissue, it's, you know, her DNA is coded in a certain way to survive off of carbs in a certain way, in a different way than, say, someone who doesn't have that post-traumatic slave syndrome or that intergenerational trauma passed down to them does. And I think that when people are looking at, I know this is, you know, not a conversation about obesity or body image or anything like that, but when we think about obesity as a issue and in medical textbooks, it says it's a Black issue and Black people are more likely to have diabetes and high blood pressure. I think that people are not taking into account the environments that a lot of us are existing in, that post-traumatic stress environment, mm-hmm. that reality of not being able to access healthy foods and not being able to talk to someone about your feelings or have a community that will hold space for you because they too are dealing with post-traumatic slave syndrome and intergenerational trauma. And almost it comes down to the way we interpersonally react to each other. We've sometimes embodied the violence that we've experienced or the colonization and racism that we've experienced, and we project that onto others. And we continue to perpetuate the harm that occurred. And people will always bring up this idea of Black on Black crime when we say Black Lives Matter, or when we say there's state violence that is specifically targeting Black people. And they're not considering the ways in which our cities have been divided by freeways and mm-hmm. the way that we've been educated to hate ourselves and therefore hate others that look like us, and not considering all of the elements that went into creating that social circumstance and all the trauma that went into creating people who are expressing their feelings by being violent. You know, my partner, David, always says anger is a secondary emotion. Like, before that is sadness. And I'm just thinking about all those kids that I grew up with in my elementary, middle school, who were Black kids, who were told that they were angry by their teachers and kicked out of school. Like, how much were they hurting? How much trauma were they holding? And if we had more conversations about Black, Indigenous, people of color, mental health, like we've had since 2008 with this Awareness Month, how different would their futures have been if they weren't getting kicked out of school?
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. My guest host this month, David Gudiel, and you're just hearing from Aaliyah Sade. And we're talking about BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month and the inequities in mental health care, because we keep calling for more mental health professionals and more mental health care. But the cautionary tale is we need to look at what kind of mental health care is helpful for certain populations. What is going to be something that's useful, and what are we missing today? And as David brought up, if we don't pay attention to the persistent traumatic stress environments that people, BIPOC communities live in, then we're not going to be able to treat the mental health needs. David, just go back to you or to Ali, whoever wants to answer. Only 2% of the American Psychiatric Association or Psychological Association clinicians identify as Black, only 2%. Is it necessary to have good treatment, to have more clinicians with BIPOC, from the BIPOC community, or do we have to retrain clinicians in general?
I can take that one. I know for me, when I was utilizing the counseling services at Cal Poly, I had Dr. Shelley Brown, and she was a Black woman. And when I spoke about my issues, being a student of color at a predominantly white institution, she held space for me and affirmed me in ways that I didn't know I could be affirmed and heard. So I think that there is definitely a benefit, but I think it was at the expense of her experience as a Black woman navigating that allowed for us to relate. And when she was no longer rehired, the following year, I struggled to go back to counseling services to go with a white man. And I think that, we shared the same identities of gender, like being a man, but there was definitely like a big disconnect in the way that wasn't with Dr. Brown. But it just calls to the attention of like, the work, I know her work was great and she was doing work, but I think it was just because of her experiences that allowed to have that more one-on-one connection. And it kind of is like, well, she didn't deserve to have those experiences. Like, I didn't deserve to have these experiences. It's kind of like getting to the larger picture as to how we're able to connect in those ways, as opposed to like training and things like that. I think it gets dicey because some people view it as a check mark, but I don't see it as a check mark when it gets to, I might not have all these identities with other people, and I might not share them. I might have privileged identities that they don't. But I think for me, I don't see it as a checkbox. It's a consistent learning process. It's a consistent dismantling process. It's a critical reflection of what imposed these differences between us, or who imposed these differences between us. That's kind of how I see it.
I'm not even sure what my next question is because my mind is spinning. Because part of me wants to go back to what Aaliyah was talking about, the inequities in healthcare. And if you don't understand the lived experience of the person in your room, you cannot provide them with healthcare. So what does appropriate healthcare look like? I think that, and I don't think we have an answer in this moment, but what are the steps to get there? Do we need more collective community health care instead of, and this is just my thought, throw it to you, but in my mind, part of our weakness is that we look at individuals as being their own entity and not looking at the individual as part of community. Mm-hmm. And I think for BIPOC communities, that is taken away, that opportunity to get healing as a community and not just looking at individuals as having mental health problems. I don't know if that makes sense, but because I feel like you're talking about the lived experiences of a community. And if you can't come together as a community and share those lived experiences, then you end up feeling like you alone are the problem.
Mm-hmm. And this is the beautiful thing about shifting our language. Because when we name all those different parts of ourselves, then we can begin to find communities of care and practitioners of care who can actually meet our needs and empathize with our experience, not just sympathize with it, mm-hmm. and think of culturally relevant tools to offer. And I think that collective care is so important, and it is our duty, everyone's duty, to uplift those communities of care rather than kind of siloing everyone into therapists who are already overwhelmed. And I think when we are thinking about, should we have more therapists of color? Should we have more people from the BIPOC communities? I think that, yeah, that would be powerful. But just like there's Black cops that are still perpetuating state violence, we are not meeting the root of the issue and tackling it on its head. We have to really unravel and unpack all the ways that each part of our lives is connected to oppression and privilege, and begin imagining what that future looks like. And I know you said that there is no solution that we can say right now in this 1 hour conversation, but I hope that everything that we've been saying is encouraging a bit of mm-hmm. critique in the things that we're involved in, and whether they're really healing or are they just perpetuating harm.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, when we think of a solution, we think of a stationary and situation, like this solution is going to fix this problem. But the solutions Angela Davis, freedom is a constant struggle. It's like looking at things that as a consistent shifting, consistent learning, and more, you know, it's like happiness is not a destination, but a direction. So it's kind of like looking at things like that. Yeah.
Well, and I think then, you know, this idea of discomfort that I started the show with, we have to be willing to sit in discomfort. We have to be willing to be uncomfortable and continue growing, because the minute you get that license and then you sit back in your chair and think, well, I have a license as a mental health professional, so clearly I know this business. Or as soon as we feel like we've gotten to any sort of place where we have authority or, you know, more efficient, then everything starts to get stifled. So to me, part of the work is, how do we keep sitting in the discomfort and having conversations that make us feel anxious and not be afraid to maybe say the wrong thing and have to get corrected? I think that's where a lot of the work starts, and especially for professionals who, and I can relate to this from the profession, out of some insecurity of our own skills, we start to hide behind the license and say, no, I have this, I'm a professional, and that prevents growth.
And this is the moment where we move away from political correctness and professionalism and into care and radical courage. And I hope that we can unpack that more in the next upcoming weeks.
We certainly will. David Gudiel and Alea Sade, thank you so much for kicking us off this week, BIPOC Mental Health Awareness Month. If you'd like to connect with either of them, send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and I will pass the info along. I look forward to seeing where this month takes us. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back next Tuesday at 2:00. Mm-hmm.